Eric.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Great. So I followed you to Denmark.
Yes.
Saw you in London not too long ago.
Yes, that's right. So we're here in Jarl.
Yeah.
And, you know, we ran into Dave Thomas here.
Hey.
Hey. Good to see you.
Nice to see you. So who are you, Dave?
Who am I, huh? I'm the object troll. Probably to some of your viewers, I'm from the dark side, having been involved with the creation of Eclipse and horrible dynamic languages like Smalltalk that normal people could use.
Ah, that's the dark side?
Well, to some, but I understand there's many more people becoming enlightened about these things these days.
So, you know, I actually have heard Smalltalk mentioned several times since I've been here. I mean, what is it about Smalltalk?
I think it had four dynamic object languages had a unique combination of features and environment. A simple language with a keyword syntax so that people could essentially express their own DSLs without having to have a tool effort. So it was very easy to use. So it was very popular with engineers and business people to be able to essentially extend the language because of the keyworded syntax. It didn't look threatening to people who were not sort of, quote, professional developers in the software, in the computer science sense, but who were professionals building software from an applications perspective.
Interesting.
And it had, of course, the simple ideas, which are now popular in things like Ruby, of a single, simple object model, class libraries, and didn't have all the complexities of, you know, type systems and complex types, and didn't have to do things like generics because there were simple polymorphic collections.
So what's going on, Eric? How come we're, you know, let's talk about the direction that we are now.
I mean, yes, but I mean, the question is, you know, I really like Smalltalk too, but why did it never caught on really, you know, to the big audience, right? Why isn't this kind of really widespread? Why did languages like Java or, you know, C++ or C#, why did they catch on, and why is Smalltalk still kind of, you know, a niche language loved by the kind of, you know, experts, but unknown to the kind of masses?
Well, I mean, I don't want to harp on Smalltalk because, you know, there's lots of good languages in history from, you know, vector languages, and many languages have come and gone, and that language life is really, you know, dominated by the worse is better kind of metaphor, and the reality is that Smalltalk was on a compounded growth, 30% growth rate in the early mid-90s, but Java was really about Java OS, and, you know, for companies like, you know, IBM and Sun, Java OS was really the big play, and that was to take on Windows, and so the investment really wasn't in Java, was really not so much about Java as application development language, but as Java OS as a platform. And of course, when and that also started the price war, where languages essentially were a giveaway. You know, basically, I'll give you Visual Age for Java for $9.95. You give me your J++ disk. And so it became Java became the manly perfume scent, right, that you sprayed on top of your WebSphere or whatever platform giveaway. So, I mean, basically, there was a much bigger platform agenda going on, and the general rule is whenever the large players play a platform agenda, other technologies lose, because languages are really just a small piece of the whole thing, and platforms are really the big game.
So, I mean, as a language designer yourself, I mean, so languages are just a small piece of a bigger puzzle. Why do we have people who have completely embraced Ruby and dynamic languages and decided that, or even have stated that the languages that we're most used to, the imperative static type ones, C#, Java, maybe that was a mistake that those were created. Everyone should be writing dynamic.
Well, I'm not so sure. But first of all, for example, if you look at Ruby, it's not only the language that kind of attracts people, right? It's like frameworks like Rails that kind of then attract people to Ruby. So it's kind of a combination again. The language is, I think, a small part of the whole picture, and it's often also, you know, the frameworks or libraries that draw people to it. And I'm, well, you know, my opinion about purely dynamic languages is, I think, kind of, you know, well known. I think, you know, when you're only have, you know, purely dynamic languages, you're throwing a little bit the baby away with the bathwater, because at some point, you know, static typing is good, because at some point you want to kind of, you know, crystallize your program where you want to have more kind of static checking and safety. And sometimes, yes, especially kind of in the early phases of development, you want to have dynamic typing. So I think you want to have this kind of dial that you can, you know, switch between static and dynamic typing. And this is a trend that is kind of, you really see, is what people call hybrid typing.
Nice.
Where you have this combination of static and dynamic typing.
Yeah,
I just want to come back to that. I don't want to be left in the small talk museum here.
No.
I think the reality is that language progress in terms of having sort of pluggable type systems or things that you can turn them off. The problem, we sort of got stuck in these two worlds of purely dynamic and purely static, and neither of which are complete for really doing the whole life cycle. And the other issue is that we need to have multiple languages. It's dumb to take one technology and, you know, write your TCP/IP stack in Ruby, even if you could do it and get the badge of honor. Right? So I think the way things are going forward is that both between tooling, supporting it, the kinds of, I think, very clever things that are done, that, you know, Eric's done in terms of the local type inference and things like that. Certainly the notion of duck types and things like that. These are all really important, and it's just hard and challenging to get all the pieces together so things work and not blow the complexity up. Like, you know, absolutely, if you put generics in there that no human can survive, right? Because it's just, you know, classes plus generics, but why don't you add prototypes too, you know? And so, you know, you can make an ECMA 49 and nobody will ever be able to implement it.
So, I mean, would it be possible to create a runtime that could be generic, static and dynamic?
Absolutely.
Dave, you know, you had some ideas about that, right? So can you...
We actually built a technology called the Universal Virtual Machine, or UVM. Ultraviolet magic or sunburn, depending what you want to call it.
Interesting.
But which basically ran multiple languages, including old ones like Rex and VB and so on a single virtual machine infrastructure. I think one of the challenges is to really decide how you want to combine a language like C or C++, sort of the machine level language, with this. .NET took one strategy, but I think the work was done on some technology Microsoft bought called Calusa and so on with the B machine is actually a better strategy for doing that, and it provides a better way, much less complicated, to combine a set of dynamic languages with a C-level language. It's sort of much simpler than the managed code approach, which I think is pretty complicated, as Microsoft has found out.
Interesting. So you're specifically talking about how a C++ developer would interoperate with managed classes by using, managed C++, which is just marking your classes collected.
Well, no, I'll just say there's a different implementation technology is to actually combine, you know, the sort of B machine approach, where you compile to a very simple, sort of idealized kind of RISC processor, and that allows you to compile the C code and the dynamic language code to the same target. It gives you a lot more portability, a lot more flexibility, a lot more simplicity. And you can handle things like pointers and exception throws and things like that by inserting inline checks, and then you can, given good static code analysis, remove those inline checks. So that's the kind of technology that lost at Microsoft to .NET, but I think it's actually a better technology for building virtual machines.
Interesting. And you agree, Eric?
Well, now you're asking me a hard question, but I think, and let me say it like that, I have said many times that, yes, this idea of that virtual machine, they use something called software fault isolation. So the idea is that you don't have, like, you know, a type system that all these languages are buying into, but instead you're compiling to this kind of, you know, like RISC machine code, and then all memory accesses are checked to get, you know, safety, memory safety. Mm-hmm. But you don't try to do that, you know, by enforcing a type system on it. So it's much more in the much more feel of a kind of dynamic language, where, you know, you're checking things at runtime instead of kind of, you know, checking them like statically and using that to enforce certain guarantees.
Absolutely. I mean, well, we had this. I interviewed some people yesterday where we were having the static versus dynamic debate. Now they were all, you know, Eric wasn't there unfortunately because we miscommunicated about meeting or I just didn't see each other around. But they were all definitely were on the dynamic side. But that was one of the questions that came up. That was the notion of performance hit in a every time everything's being calculated and computed at runtime.
Yeah. Well, you know, the reality is that most applications make most of the things that the application does are operating system calls and disk I/O and you know, and working in really bad libraries. So, you know, the actual application performance of most of the virtual machines today for scripting are really bad. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they work shows the fast hardware and the fact that the application performance is really dominated by other factors. But we shipped, you know, just, you know, embedded Smalltalk in virtual machines inside of, you know, oscilloscopes, command and radar multiprocessor, command and control systems, talking to high-performance sampling radars and doing that. So, again, a lot of this is choose the right technology for the right thing. And so, basically, you know, if you were a dynamic language guy and you were doing this, you'd basically say, okay, I got my algorithms and my objects in C. I've got this, or I got my application structure here. My program's working. I've got a hotspot, so I'll write that method in C or assembler, something like that. Use the right technology for the right job.
Absolutely. Now, as we move into the world in the age of multi-core, it seems that what people are saying, and we've had this conversation, Eric, on, you know, with Simon Peyton Jones and you and various other people, Anders, that we're moving towards more of a need for functional programming constructs, even if they're hidden in an imperative language or made obvious like you've done with lambda expressions, right? So let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I mean,
there's not really a question there. It's just a topic.
No, I think everyone agrees that, you know, any enlightened individual will basically realize. I mean, the roots of object orientation actually come from doing closures and trapping state in lambdas. So, I mean, that's where this stuff, you know, comes from, has its roots in actor languages and so on. So clearly it's true that people want to move towards concurrency, and most good dynamic languages have mapping, have MapReduce, whether it's used with blocks or lexical closures or whatever it is. So these are the mechanisms that, you know, data parallelism is the easy way, and then you need some simple abstraction for concurrency, which in the systems we built, we use something called actors, which are actually active objects, which you can subclass. You can build servers and client agents and workflows, so you don't have to. You can build an object-oriented workflow instead of having to use this, you know, BARF, BPEL, 4WS, if you can even say it, right? Angle. You know, I mean, how are you going to architect a complex workflow? But if you have an object-oriented thing, you can script it with actors, you can do real object-oriented programming for concurrency. Mm-hmm. So that lets you choreograph actual small, fine-grained concurrency, and then combined with that, you do, you know, large-scale concurrency with something like data parallelism through MapReduce.
Interesting.
But functional, I mean, most design patterns, people who know functional programming, those are idioms in their language, right?
Okay.
You know, you don't learn about a strategy and so on if you're a functional programmer. You just use it every day.
Sure.
MapReduce, all these.
But it's really, you know, you need to virtually be a mathematician. I mean, to write in, say, Eric's favorite language, Haskell. I mean, it's hard for general purpose. Most programmers are general purpose programmers, right? Most people who program on Windows, for example, aren't the subclass who are writing drivers. They're writing applications way up in user mode. They're not mathematicians.
Right. But so. having taught business students and engineers functional programming, there are many, many things like AutoCAD and so on, which has a scheme interpreter inside it. Most people actually find this a lot easier to do than they do trying to use something, some sort of procedural or statically typed object-oriented language. And the reality is the code's a lot smaller. So one of the big problems with object software is bloat.
Okay.
And that's because you don't have higher-order functions in most languages, so you can't build up these notions through combining functions to build high-order ones. You can't do this kind of dynamic parameterization. You can't have adaptive systems which will choose different functions depending on where they are, or whether it's you're going through a linear region or a nonlinear region for doing an integration or something. And I think the reality is that you can... there are lots and lots of people who have... who still today do a lot of work with these languages. If you look at, for example, the finance community, there are very, very high-performance people, many of them doing things that in a family of languages, the vector languages, best known through APL and J and so on, and K. These languages are very, very fast, arguably faster than many people can write the code in C++, for good reasons, if you look at their design. The primitives are very fast. The interpreter doesn't need to be fast because most of the time is spent inside of the vector computations. These can be taught to business students, and they can wow their professors and wow their employers by seeing this. I mean, we have clients that do billion row queries.
Wow.
Produce their answers, and they go home at night having their application written in a few hours. Now, the answer is these languages are high barrier in some sense because you have to learn them, and one of the things you're doing is you're seeing new kind of extended SQLs to be able to reach these that contain these functional constructs. However, once you climb that barrier, you can get a lot done in a day. And so the real issue is, it's true that you can get a piano with five keys and make kind of interesting music. It's just a lot of work, right? Or you can get a really beautiful instrument with lots of keys and the organ, and you have to learn how to play that organ. But once you learn how to play that, you can really go. Witness a guy who can really fly Emacs or someone fly Visual Studio or Eclipse, who actually knows all the buttons and so on. So again, it's an instrument. If you invest and you don't mind climbing in the experience and learning this, one of the challenges is, particularly for a language like Haskell, they have a sort of mathematical arrogance to them in a certain sense. Right? And I think the key thing for the Haskell community is to sort of reach out and try and understand that everyone doesn't understand domain and range, right, and all those concepts. And people are intimidated. But my experience, for instance, teaching languages like APL and Scheme, is if you actually focus on the examples and you drop the mathematical sort of vocabulary and all the other stuff, which is beautiful by itself, but if you're an engineer or you're a business guy, you just want to get your app done.
Yeah.
But these languages are much more compact and much simpler to use than lots of others. But people have not taken them out. So I think there's a huge marketing opportunity there for these people to basically take these languages and cross them over so they can explain. Because the languages actually are simpler to use.
Sure.
And very compact and very efficient.
Once you understand them.
Right.
Once you can speak fluently in the language.
Once you can use the idioms of the language.
Sure.
But it's a hell of a lot easier to learn these things in a functional language than it is to try and figure out how to learn all the design patterns and all the other machinery you need to try and do the same thing.
Interesting. So, I mean, Eric, that then brings the question of what you guys are doing in C# and VB then, right? So you're trying to mask, in some sense, these functional idioms for people who probably don't want to understand them, so you can...
I wouldn't call that mask. I think what we're trying to do is precisely what Dave is saying, is we're taking the same concepts from functional programming, like lambda expressions and so on, but we're trying... And monads, in some sense, these are the query comprehensions, but we're not calling them like that, because these names can be intimidating, right? If you just say, this is a query expression, or you say, this is a monad, right? So we're not really kind of hiding it, we're just kind of, bringing it in a less intimidating package.
Sure.
And I think that's important, but you should also understand that the the place where functional programming comes from is from mathematics, and these people are often have a theoretical background, so the lingo that they use and the kind of the way they reason and so on is quite different. So yes, you have to have this crossover where, you know, these things are not scary, they are not difficult, you don't have to be a mathematician to use it. And you just have to kind of look through all these kind of, you know, complicated, you know, expensive sounding words. But in some sense, it's the same with objects, right? If, you know, you hear people talk about design pattern, visitor, state pattern, whatever, then you get intimidated too. And if you look into them, usually they are not that complicated either. So, sure. And it's all a matter of kind of how do you market this? How do you kind of, you know, make this approachable? Mm-hmm. So to say something also a little bit about the analogy with the instruments, I think that's a good one. I think if you look at like playing an instrument, right, you cannot grab somebody from the street and turn them into like, you know, a violin player, a concert violin player in like 5 days or something. It takes a lot of practice. Yeah. And I think it's the same with programming. Yeah, programming is hard, or, you know, if you're really doing, you know, complicated algorithms and so on. So you cannot expect that, you know, there's no silver bullet, right? We can try to make it easier and remove the noise, but, you know, it's just essentially these problems are difficult.
Sure.
And so I do believe that it still requires a lot of practice, a lot of education. Mm-hmm. It's an engineering discipline. And yes, you know, like in the house, you have do-it-yourselfers where you can do simple jobs. But mm-hmm. I think, you know, if like mission-critical systems or, you know, writing an operating system, that's very specialized.
Absolutely. And no, we're not, you can't do it in Visual Basic, right? All I meant by that was, you can't... you have to use a lower level programming language.
That's not necessary. People are writing Haskell and operating system in Haskell right down on the bare metal.
Nice.
And for example, they use that for highly secure systems, because if you do it in a low level language, you have all kind of, you know, problems with pointers and, you know, what we see with, you know, that's where you get all the security errors like buffer overruns and so on.
Of course.
So you want to write these low level things in higher level language where you can prevent a host of security problems that are only there because the languages are too low level.
Yeah, one of the things that people don't realize is if you have a very compact virtual machine, the virtual machine can't actually model the state of the chips in the processor. So you can actually control what you can't do with like a compiler, because it spreads everything out. You'd have to have 1,000 minus options to try and do that. But with a virtual machine, you can have a state model and a stack model, and you can place things in individual registers. You can put them on chip or off chip. So you can actually take care of very scarce machine resources. So you can actually get better performance with a dynamic virtual machine than you can often with other code, because in the end, it's how much code is on chip, how close is it in the cache, am I taking advantage of the fact that I've got delay slots which I can plug in. I can do that with a terrible virtual machine, and I can't do it with my C compiler or my C# compiler without a huge amount of work and a lot of options, because in a virtual machine, the actual runtime that I need to control is very, very small, and I can place those instructions for both the memory manager and the execution infrastructure where they are. So there's just a lot of opportunities there. As I said, we built real-time command and control multiprocessor 1980s using Smalltalk and, you know, some C code to talk to the other bits, right?
So now would it? So I always remember, and maybe this isn't a crazy idea, but I remember I had interviewed some Windows architects a couple of years ago, Rob Short et al. And during there, I had sort of alluded to Rob about the notion of would it be why have an operating system with one big kernel, and why not couldn't you have an operating system that was composed of virtual machines, each one with a specific task. One deals with dealing with hardware and that kind of stuff. The other one could be the shell, and they can communicate via a local network. Would that scale, though? Would that architecture? Does it make sense?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the work on, particularly the work on network communications operating systems and so on, actually works that way, in the sense that And certainly it solves a lot of the issues of protection and DLL hell, now
Absolutely.
Called the class library hell.
Sure.
Basically because you get everything runs in its own virtual machine, right? So much
yeah.
simpler, and you can run different versions of the virtual machines, and you can tailor the virtual machines to different jobs. So you can, you know, one could be tailored to run the Haskell-like language, even to say, okay, well, this is going to be really good for this kind of problem.
Sure.
Versus over here, I want the one that runs the .NET-style languages. It, basically, you have a huge, there's a big cultural bias brought by the computer science community about C-like languages and objects in these languages. It's basically...
Let's talk about why. Why is that
well,
the case?
Well, I think it's partly... Unix is, I think, to blame, right? The success of Unix. And the other issue is most computer science programs still today do not teach people about, you know, what read, eval, print is really like, right? They don't see... structure interpretation of computer programs or Haskell or any of these languages, so people don't really know what goes on in the machine.
Why not? I mean, why on earth would they not?
Well, I think one of the things is that, you know, industry responds. Universities today, unfortunately, are far too driven by industry. I mean, DARPA takes, you know, makes people rewrite their code from, you know, a language where it works to C++ just because they think industry uses it. Then they tell them, well, we're going to fund you to rewrite it in Java now because no one's doing C++ anymore. So the result is the entire educational system, particularly in North America, is heavily driven by what faculty perceive to be what industry wants. So this basically sees graduate students doing all sorts of things, slaving away, trying to make something work in Visual Studio or Eclipse or whatever it is, which is a cruel and unnatural act, no matter how easy one could say, you know, Eclipse or Visual Studio is, versus letting them actually solve the interesting problem with the best technology, and then if you've got to go implement it with, you know, if you really have to use cement to build this thing and you know, hammers and sticks, well, you can get paid to do that. But as a result, you find university programs now who only teach Java, only teach C Sharp. They may teach UML as well, you know, and that's it. So you basically have a 3-year degree, and you have employers who are willing to hire basically saying, a 2-year, certified Java developer, right? Mm-hmm. Where certified almost means incompetent, right? Basically, you know, it's a test that anybody could pass, right? and so they said, well, the good thing about Java programmers, I talked to one nameless CIO with a very large American corporation, is the good thing about Java programmers is they're so cheap, right? So we love Java, right? But they don't realize the kind of disaster that these people are creating with frameworks and so on, because these people don't understand objects, they don't understand how to do all this design. So there's this huge Java legacy, and I'm sure C#, you know, legacy, which no one will be able to maintain because these languages, the complexity barrier with the libraries, the languages themselves are hard, but once you get all the libraries and frameworks in there, no one knows what's going on. These people are dying. Right? I mean, I think that was a big mistake of Microsoft and VB, right? And I think the things that Eric and the team, VB team, have done are really kick-ass for VB users.
In terms
by
of what?
In terms of link and making these kinds of facilities there and actually getting VB back towards a language which is less like
VB.
Something that, you know, that a normal person could write a program in versus, you know, a supposedly software, you know, professional. It's clear that most software professionals can't do objects either.
Sure.
But, you know, in the end, you should be able to sit down and use something like Access and build a real app, or do something like VB and build a real app. I shouldn't have to go and say, well, you know real men use, you know, C#, right? You know, and have all this, you just hit this huge complexity wall, and now people are, you've disenfranchised them from me being able to build applications.
It's true. Absolutely correct.
And so I think most people don't have professional developers, and there's going to be an acute shortage, right? Mm. I mean, you know, we've been through the desert of, you know, the .bomb, but if you start looking at any of the demographics worldwide, you know, India is coming to Australia to hire, right?
Wow.
So you're going to see a huge shortage, and so, you know, high barrier complexity is going to be a problem. So you're either going to have to find some place to get all these genius programmers who can figure out how to use these 42 stacks of frameworks and object relational mapping, and I should have been voted off the island, you know, all this complex stuff, or you're going to have to find a much simpler way so that people can say, look, in the end, most applications, something like 80% of sort of e-business applications, don't use any objects. languages, right? They don't need them. The only reason you need them is because the only language they give you to build them is an object-oriented programming language. But in fact, a simple functional extension to something like SQL could easily solve 90%, 80, 90% of the applications people write.
Interesting.
Because all they do is go to three or four heterogeneous data sources, aggregate the data, turn it into this, and put it on the screen. What do you do now? You're in an object language. You go out there, you got to go through an object relational framework, you got to bring it into memory, turn it all into objects, erase the garbage collector, create all this huge crap of objects, select 10 of them from 10,000, you materialize, poof, that's gone. Oh, no, you got to reserialize that out in XML, right, and send it out. You just wasted all these cycles. It's a completely brain-dead design, right? Makes no sense. There are no business objects in this problem. The only objects are the ones that the vendors make us use.
Very interesting. So, thoughts, reflections on that?
Well, I want to kind of go back a little bit to the educational problem. So I do see that, you know, universities are getting more and more kind of practically oriented, whereas I think they should really pave the way and, you know, build the foundation for the future. Which means that, you know, they should be doing basic research. They should not be trying to do kind of things that are immediately practical.
Amen.
And whenever I give talks at universities, this is what I emphasize. I say, you know, you guys should not do this stuff that you're currently doing. It scares the hell out of me because, you know, if what will be there, you know, in 10 years or 25 years if these people in universities are not building this for us or, you know, thinking about it.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the question is, though, we market our products, our development products, and this is everybody, not just Microsoft.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Productivity, right? Simplicity, quickness to get started. Fire it open. We're going to make all this code for you by default. Learn a little bit about objects and rock and roll. Here's a giant class library for you to use. Go build the next generation, whatever. And you'll be productive. It'll be secure, and everyone will be happy. But at the same time, that can be done, but you don't really know what's really going on. You don't have the computer science background, so you don't know that maybe you didn't design it correctly. So I guess that is my question. I mean, if I'm a company, I want to hire somebody that will come in and be productive. And I need this app done in 6 months. I don't care whether or not
but,
you understand
that. But that's a little
that
bit
pattern.
Like smoking, right? You know,
well,
you want immediately satisfaction, but you know that in the long term you're going to die.
I understand.
Right? And I think this is kind of a trade-off you have to make. You have to, of course, you want to have kind of immediate satisfaction, and we need programmers now, but you shouldn't forget, you shouldn't eat your seed corn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, and that's, I think, what we're doing now in universities. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, there's some radically different way to write programs. Or you don't know, or like now with the many core stuff that's coming, we need to kind of solve these hard problems, and those are not things that we can solve tomorrow.
Sure.
So we need to have a good balance between long term research and immediate needs in the workplace. Mm-hmm. But I think the balance has shifted a little bit to the wrong direction.
Okay. So now you are. Let's change the topic just slightly. We could talk about this for a couple hours. Eclipse.
Yes.
You had something to do with that thing?
Yeah, I'm one of the probably principal godfathers of Eclipse.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what it is? I mean, and what's... I mean,
sure.
I've never used it because I come from a mothership.
Sure. No, Eclipse is a pretty popular IDE for principally for Java, although it does support other languages. It was actually designed as an IDE for a universal runtime.
Mm.
So that was the original idea, and so it's quite pluggable, and it's been very popular, and I think it's, you know, as known at Microsoft, I've seen some, you know, daggers in the walls. So. But I think basically the big thing about it is it's open source, it's very pluggable, and they have a very good network of relationships with suppliers and with universities and so on. So you know, I think that's now. You know, Eclipse is all written in Java, and I think that demonstrates that, you know, it's actually possible to build something like Eclipse in Java, but it's also, you know, certainly by anyone's analysis, you know, any time a software passes a three or four versions, you know, there's obviously things would like one would like to do, but it's very pluggable, and I think that's really the easier. It's a lot easier to plug into than Visual Studio, mainly because it's newer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, I'm sure any time you get to do something, a new version of something clean, you hopefully do a better job than you did the last time.
Excellent. So, you know, sort of a broad question as we wind down. We still have a little more time, but I mean, what do you guys see as the future of languages, in the sense that, you know, right now, as we mentioned earlier, you have this Ruby thing, and then there's the object thing. What other sort type do you think could evolve? For example, object-oriented programming, object orientation was successful, right? Do you consider... So my random babbling question, I'll try to be specific. So it's definitely sort of like ecology, right?
Sure.
Things win and other things don't, regardless of how good something might be. Certain designs win. Why did object orientation win? Why did these big languages that we're talking about, why did static typing win? Or if it's not anymore, but can we talk about that?
Sure.
Like, what? Why?
I think, again, it's, you know, in the end, platforms... turn out to dominate the thing, and basically the existing, you know, if for people, I mean, arguably many vendors build tools that they would like to use themselves, not necessarily what their customers want.
Sure.
Witness VBE on .NET, for example.
Yes.
And I think the result is that, you know, objects are better than the previous stuff. I mean, they give you encapsulation, they give you the ability. So for people building system software, they're better. But they get, you know, at least the current languages that are popular are pretty difficult for building applications. I mean, I find it hard to believe that people would actually build business applications in Java or C#, because that's a huge legacy, a very difficult code to maintain. So I think in the going to the future question is the real opportunity is recognizing that there is really no need for people to do all the stuff they have to do today. And I really believe that's fundamentally a language problem, whether it's through an extended sort of SQL, where it's a new functional language, whether it's a vector functional language. I can see lots of possibilities there. But I think... and the other issue is that objects are really a performance bottleneck when it comes to the runtime and the execution infrastructure. So in my kind of world, I would know the future, I see a language which has objects in the modeling layer but not in the execution infrastructure, which may be a little radical, but that provides a lot of opportunity for memory management, for parallelism and things like that, but still lets you have the modeling capability for objects when you need, and that may be a slightly radical thought, except that there are those technologies in production use today.
Interesting. Very interesting. That's sort of, you know.
So Dave, I have a question about that. So how would you, do you mean that now, like, you know, inheritance and dynamic dispatch are useless, or how would that work if you don't have objects in the implementation level?
Well, I think it's really what is your memory model for the objects, right? In the sense that right now, a lot of the issues are that you really want to work in a world where there's only collections. So you really don't want scalers. Scalers are really a problem. They make implementations slower, less efficient. They have to worry about storage allocation and things like that. Makes it difficult, for instance, as you know, basically trying to mix the worlds of XML and relational technology with object technology. If you can basically use alternative representations for those objects, which are more like what you would find at the machine level and more compact and collection level, then you can actually get higher performance, more parallelism, and so on. You have to do the work to maintain the abstraction model and so on. But I certainly don't think dynamic dispatch is the answer to everyone's problems.
Mm-hmm. What about... In the multi-core world, having to deal with statement-based languages. So what I mean by that is imperative languages are fundamentally single core, in the sense that it's hard to split things apart. It's target certain cores asynchronously and then put them back together. If you're just saying do this, then do this, then do this, then do this, then do this.
Yeah, sure, but like at some level, you know, a lot of algorithms become sequential, right? So I think it's too simplistic to say, you know, oh, we kind of do everything using asynchronous programming or something. I think there's various levels. David Callahan has also a nice analogy. He calls it the concurrency elephant, right? Because from, if you look at the problem from different sides, you know, a lot of people just look at it from one side and they say, this is it. No, you have to take a little bit of a distance, and then you see that there's many aspects with concurrency. And at some point, even you have to do kind of, you know, shared memory concurrency, because there's two things that are trying to, you know, if we're going to a light bulb and we're trying to turn it on at the same time, there's some shared state that we're trying to change.
Yeah,
It's not that simple, unfortunately.
You need to look at history here. When in the early 80s, there was this wonderful language called Prolog that came out.
Hmm.
And basically everyone said, well, all you need to know is logic now, and logic plus, you know, control, or forget what you mean, is programming, right?
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, my funding went to zero because I was doing objects, and, you know, logic programming was in, right? And, you know, Japan was the leader, and, you know, we said, well, look, in the end, you know, all computers, you know, computers are about evaluation and making bindings. Bindings tend to be inherently sequential. And finally, about 5 years later, the people who were, and of course, because these were all logic programs and no state, you know, these would run at blazingly speed and they would all run parallel and so on. And I think it was only 5 years in, by 1985, there was a published proof that the maximum speed up was going to be like 7 or something like that, because unification, which is the key binding mechanism in logic programming, is inherently sequential.
Hmm.
So there's no free lunch.
Yes,
and by the way, by the time people figure out how to make program multicores, the multicores are going to be gone. Right. It's just a very, very low yield investment for people to do application level programming, I'm talking about, to use a multicore. There are very few people who can do it. You're going to see that already with Woodstock, which is an old chipset now, it's much easier to program than it was before. The vendors are realizing that just, you know, arbitrarily sharing a set of gates because it's easy is just too hard to program. So while you're going to see some things there and some people are going to take advantage of them, I think you're going to see a lot of people are going to use these as data parallelism, and there's going to be lots and lots of cores. And so you're going to get past this current short-term bottleneck of 4 or 8 cores and be in a lot of cores. And it's just way too hard. It's just a cruel and unnatural act to try and program these things. So normal people are never going to be programming multi-cores, in my view.
Interesting. But, okay, but then, so then that comes back to the notion of, you know, what the popular thing now, and we've talked about it already, are runtimes, right? So you have the language, the little wrapper on top of this fat runtime, and the runtime does all this work for you. Then it's going to be up to the runtime people, not the guys who are programming on top, to take care of, so you could create libraries that would make it easy for me to program and say, I want to target multi-core by using some sort of language construct.
Well, I mean, I think that's the benefit if you have abstractions such as LingQ has.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually use functional abstractions in a current language, then you can get the data parallelism or things like that for free. And if you provide things like whether they're cords or actors or whatever it is, which actually, I mean, the big problem now is you basically got some block and tackle, everybody's peeing and veeing on things, you know, or semaphores, right, which is really messy in the current object languages. But if you unify and make an active object, like an actor, then you can do real object-oriented programming to do actual actors and concurrency.
Mm-hmm.
So you unify the notion of the concurrency and the actor, and you get back, and that's called a revolutionary thing, a monitor. You know, which is a really old, another really old idea, which actually works, right? As opposed to separating, you know, the thread and the state and all that stuff, which is truly horrific, especially in Java.
Absolutely. Well, it is in most languages. It's hard to program. I wish we could do away with threads, but that's a whole other argument. I don't know what they'd be replaced with, but it'd be nice.
Well, again, I think they have their place too, right? Because what is wrong with threads? I mean, if you want to do things, you know, in parallel, they have to run somewhere, which is usually a thread, right?
Yeah.
So, and we can try to make threads more lightweight or something. But I
you
think
just
fundamentally,
have to know about them.
You shouldn't have
you
to
know
about them.
About them. Yes, but
exactly. Like I don't know about what my cells are doing most of the time, but you know, things can repair or what. You know what I mean? It's like it's like we were talking about this before. The evolution of programming languages seems to be towards abstraction. A small talk was very. I love of abstractions, C-sharp, VB
yes,
especially.
But, yes, but here you have to be, with abstraction, you have to be really careful, right? Because abstraction is about leaving out unnecessary detail.
Okay.
And often it's too easy to leave out necessary detail, and then the abstractions become useless. And also often, you know, the and some people don't like this, but I think abstraction should be leaky, because often, you know, you cannot do it everything you want on the abstraction level, so you have to kind of be able to dive down. It's just like, you know, you think that you don't have to know anything about your cells, but if you get some disease, you know, you might hope that your doctor knows everything about your cells, and you know, you get some medicine that will kind of, you know, influence your cells. So sometimes you have to break abstraction barriers, because, you know, you have to go down to the next lower level.
Yeah, and again, it's no free lunch.
Yes,
I mean, if you can, if you really need fine-grained parallelism and you want to be able to basically do that, then you have to have abstractions in the language that allow you to do that. And, you know, who could be better than the gentleman standing behind us?
So we should get him in here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, good.
Get us out of here.
But let me pause. No, let me just pause this so we can continue this in another video. Hey, great to meet you. And we're probably going to be seeing you soon.
Good. Thanks
as
a lot.
Always.
Okay.
Eric.
Yes, and thanks, Dave. You know, this was as always. You know, a big pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely.